They never became tired or impatient. Frankly, I was both. I began to lose my earlier enthusiasm, and felt that perhaps Feyder and the guides had overrated my psychic powers, and I was dreadfully disappointed. Now, this theater was a comparatively new one, and had recently been built by Sir Walter Gibbons, who was managing director. I knew nothing at all about him, neither did Agnes nor Nellie. We had never seen him until we came to his theater for this special production. One evening, just after we sat down for our usual sitting, Feyder had given up spelling out messages, as she said she wanted to concentrate entirely on controlling me, which made the whole thing very dull indeed. We noticed that Sir Walter, whom we had just begun to know by sight, had come down into the engine room, and was pacing about backwards and forwards, with his hands clasped behind his back. We had come down a little earlier than usual, so we simply sat, quiet as mice, in the hope that he would not notice us in the gloom. He glanced in our direction in a casual sort of way, but did not peremptorily order us to clear out, as we certainly expected him to do. Instead, he kept on pacing up and down, about 50 or 60 feet from where we sat. We thought, will he never go? And while waiting, I relapsed into an unusually sleepy state. I felt more pessimistic than ever about my psychic possibilities. The drowsy, tired feeling increased. I lazily thought, it's darker than usual tonight. I'm sleepy. They won't notice if I sleep for a little while. I slept. I awoke. It seemed to me as if I might have been asleep for a few months or for as many hours. Agnes and Nellie were leaning across the table holding my hands. I noticed they were agitated. Nellie turned the light on and I saw that tears were glistening on their cheeks. What on earth's the matter? I asked. Matter? Said Agnes. Feyder has been controlling you and giving us messages from our relatives. Nellie's mother has sent her some messages, too. We have had a wonderful time. They told me of many evidential things that had been given about matters of which I knew nothing, yet I could scarcely believe it was true. I felt too dazed and tired to enter into the spirit of joy and wonder that Agnes felt. The tired feeling soon wore off, however, and I began to feel very glad indeed that at last Feyder had succeeded in speaking through my lips. Why had it happened on this particular night, I wondered, and Agnes and Nellie told me that Feyder had pointed to where Sir Walter Gibbons was standing, and said that man's power helped Feyder to come through. Several years after, when I was carrying out my mediumship professionally, Sir Walter Gibbons was sent to me in a very indirect, roundabout manner, anonymously. It was during the war and he was in military uniform, and looked so different from the man in evening dress who had wandered in the semi-darkness of the engine room, that I never suspected his identity for one moment, but on coming into my sitting room to greet him, I experienced an extraordinary sense of power. Indeed, it was so strong, I could hardly speak to him, and felt as if I had come into contact with some enormous force. I mechanically walked over to the window to adjust the curtains, wondering how I was to pull myself together in order to sit with a man who possessed such overwhelming power. However, I did so, and as soon as Feyder came through me, she told him what had happened in his theater, how she had influenced him to come down the stairs in order that she could draw some power from him so as to be able to entrance me. At first he could remember nothing of the episode, but afterwards he recalled the whole thing, how strangely he had been impressed to go down the stairs, and stay there, though it was scarcely an inviting or enlivening place, and how he had seen three girls sitting by a little table, very quietly, and vaguely wondered what they were doing, but without their slightest inclination to interfere with them, or tell them that they had no business down there. This strange meeting with Sir Walter led to many extraordinary experiences, but I must leave them for a later chapter. Page 35. Chapter 11, Concerning an Unpleasant Experience. Feyder controlled me whenever I could find an understanding or sympathetic sitter, but I knew so few people that it was very difficult to gain the experience and practice that I ought to have had, and a great deal of time was undoubtedly wasted. Nowadays there are several excellent places in London where classes are held for the purpose of encouraging the psychic powers that are latent in everybody, but are so difficult in many cases to develop through lack of money, knowledge and instruction. I think it must be easier now for anyone who feels that mediumship is their vocation. Fortunately for my work, Agnes introduced me to some friends, among them being an old lady, a Mrs. Watkins, who, later on, absolutely pushed me into beginning my professional work. I went on sitting with one person and another, not getting forward very much as far as I could see, or doing much good. Feyder controlled me, gave quite interesting and often evidential messages to the few people with whom I sat. So in the latter end of their summer of 1913, I thought I would try and enlarge my circle of sitters. Unfortunately, I suffered slightly from neuralgia and made up my mind that I ought to have a few teeth extracted, and I went to a dentist who was highly recommended to me. I was given gas and had several teeth extracted. I left the dentist, went home, feeling, or trying to make myself feel, as cheerful as possible in the circumstances. That night I felt dreadfully tired and went to bed, almost immediately falling asleep. The very second I lost consciousness, I had a most horrid and vivid experience. I thought I was in the dentist's operating room, sitting in the dental chair, and that the gas had just been given me. I latched the doctor and dentist doing one or two little things. Moving away a stand, selecting an instrument, and so on, and then the dentist began to extract my teeth. I felt the actual pain of each extraction. I heard the scrunching noise made as several of the teeth broke in the gums instead of coming out. Remember, I had not, apparently, been conscious of any of these details at the time of the extractions, nor of any pain while under gas, or after recovering. The pain now was agonizing. I saw the doctor bending down in front of me, watching my face, and heard him say to the dentist, "Go on a little longer," but the dentist answered, "No, I think I'd better stop now. I've got a good handful." I awoke, bathed in perspiration, and shaking with pain. Summoning all my self-control, I assured myself that it was all overstrained imagination. I had only had a kind of nightmare. I composed myself, and after a little while sleep came over me, but almost immediately I began to go through a repetition, in detail, of the same dreadful experience. Again I endured all the agony of the extractions, and again I awoke after the whole wretched operation was over. To cut a long and unpleasant story short, this happened night after night, or quite 2 weeks. I was afraid to sleep, and got into the habit of trying to doze with one eye open, terrified of letting myself go even a little way over the border for fear of undergoing their ordeal again. One afternoon I tried to go under control, hoping Feyder would come through to speak to Mrs. Watkins, the old lady with whom I had become friendly through Agnes's introduction, but as soon as I prepared myself to enter the trance condition, I felt there pain of the extractions commencing again, though not the remembrance of the dentist or the operating room, but simply the exquisite pain. For a few moments I tried to bear it, but it became worse, and I gave up the attempt. This happened every time I tried to go into trance, so I asked Mrs. Watkins to try a table sitting with me. She consented and we sat, but the power was very weak and fade only. Spelt out a few sentences slowly, and with great difficulty. She said that the shock to my nerves of the extractions, and the lack of any care, I was living alone at the time in very bad lodgings, my husband being away, no one to speak to, or do anything for me. Added to the fact that I had previously been very run down, had brought about such a weak nervous condition that I must put off any idea of beginning my work in a professional way for some months, or until she, Fader, gave me unmistakable instructions to do so. This was a great disappointment, but I felt instinctively that Fader was right. She told me that a North American Indian, called North Star, would give me some healing, and that I was to take things very quietly, only sitting occasionally for Mrs. Watkins and her sister, Mrs. Massey, or an intimate friend. I gradually grew stronger while following this advice, but was still rather afraid of going to sleep. One night, feeling very tired, I had prayed more fervently than ever that I should be spared the dental ordeal, and allowed to sleep, and to my great relief, I fell into a perfectly natural sleep for about 3 hours, waking between 3 and 4 in the morning. As I awoke, I heard a glorious baritone voice singing the beginning of their hymn, "Near on my God to Thee." I sat up in bed quickly. The voice appeared to be in the room. Fully conscious, I listened to this voice singing the whole of the first verse. It was the kind of voice that one would expect to hear in first-class opera or oratorio. Then I became aware that the sound seemed not only to be in the room, but everywhere. I jumped out of bed and opened the window. It was a bright moonlight night, the street a quiet little turning, not a soul in sight. The singer went on. Enraptured, I repeated there words of the hymn, under my breath, as the voice sang them, right on to the last line. I felt calmer than I had done for months, got quietly into bed again, conscious that I had been given a wonderfully helpful and soothing manifestation. I slept, and never again did I have that awful nightmare, or whatever it was, about the dental extractions. North Star continued to help me, or so I was told. I cannot say that I was conscious of him doing anything to me, but I certainly grew stronger very quickly. Occasionally Fader allowed North Star to control me, though she was usually averse to anybody doing so except herself. North Star was never able to speak through me. He only made a kind of guttural sound, but he used my hands and arms in an extraordinary way, making passes over the patient, and certainly he cured several people of different maladies. Sometimes patients were brought to my notice in a very strange manner. For instance, one afternoon Mrs. Watkins had invited me to her house to tea and to meet her sister, Mrs. Massey. When I arrived, Mrs. Massey was already there. She seemed very quiet and subdued. We sat drinking tea and chatting in a desultory way. Several times I had a curious feeling that there was something I ought to say, or do, to Mrs. Massey, but had no idea what it could be. The feeling puzzled me very much. I tried to remember if I had been told anything about her or been given a message for her by anyone, but could recall nothing of the kind. Now, Mrs. Watkins, Mrs. Massey and I were sitting in 3 chairs about 6 or 8 feet from each other. Mrs. Massey's chair was a wooden rocking one. Suddenly her chair began to rock backwards and forwards, gently at first, then gathering speed, till it rocked at a tremendous rate. Mrs. Massey's face was a study in expression, because As she afterwards told us, she had not started the rocking herself, she was perfectly still. When it began, then, to our horror, the chair turned a complete somersault. So did Mrs. Massey. She fell right on her head, and lay where she fell. I rushed to her, and before I realized what was happening, North Star had taken control of me. A lump, the size of an egg, had come up on Mrs. Massey's head. North Star placed my hands upon it, in a few moments it had gone. North Star then left her head alone and proceeded to make passes over her body, particularly over the heart. He gave loud grunts of satisfaction, and seemed extremely well pleased with something. After about half an hour's hard work, he stopped controlling me, and Mrs. Massey then disclosed the fact that she had felt very ill for some days past, and all the earlier part of this particular day, and had been worried about her heart. All the bad symptoms had disappeared during North Star's treatment, and she felt better now than she had done for months. Rather a drastic method employed by North Star to cure her, you'll think. But apparently, he had to create the bump on her head to open the way to treating her for the more serious complaint. Chapter 12, I begin work in earnest. In March, 1914, Faber gave Mrs. Watkins a direct message to say that I was to take some rooms where I could begin work as a professional medium as soon as possible. Faber repeated this message through friends who were psychic, through planchette, table, automatic writing, or any way she could manage. In the spring of 1914, I was deluged with these requests that I must begin at once, and every message ended with the words, "Something big and terrible is going to happen to the world. Faber must help many people through you," meaning me. I myself was impressed as never before, and with Mrs. Watkins's help I took three rooms in Maidavale and put an advertisement in a spiritualist paper to say that I gave private sittings daily, and small public circles on certain evenings. On the first evening, three people turned up for the circle, all strangers to me, and to each other, I think. I did not like my work at all at first. Honestly, I would rather have scrubbed doorsteps for a living. The sense of responsibility was overwhelming. So many people, when once they had got into communication with a spirit friend on their other side, seemed to imagine that every difficulty, every problem of their daily lives could be shelved, and all burdens placed on the shoulders of the spirit people. This is an attitude taken up by many, and I am sure it is a wrong one. Our friends in spirit life are undoubtedly allowed to help us when we cannot help ourselves, but we must shoulder our own responsibilities in order to strengthen and develop our characters. This is the purpose for which we are living on Earth, I feel sure. One day, in the middle of June, 1914, a stranger came to me for a sitting. Afterwards, she invited me to her house for a musical evening. I went the following Saturday. It was an interesting old house near Regent's Park. Their room in which we gathered to listen to the music was a long one, which had once been two rooms, but the dividing wall had been taken away. I went and sat down in the back part, with my hostess and a strange lady whom I will call Mrs. Norton. The atmosphere was very psychic and peaceful. We three sat listening to the music, when suddenly I became aware that the center of our part of the room seemed filled with a gray mist. I blinked my eyes, closed and opened them, but the mist was still there, and it grew thicker. Mrs. Norton was also looking fixedly in the direction of the mist. Then in the center of it, there gradually built up the form of a man, young and dark. He was in uniform. His face was pale and distraught. He held something in his hands, a round object which I could not see clearly. I whispered to Mrs. Norton, "Can you see anything?" She replied at once, Of course I can. I see the form of a young man in the Serbian uniform. At least, I think it is like the pictures of the Serbian uniforms I have seen. All at once I realized that he was the young King Alexander of Serbia, who had been murdered a few years previously. He seemed to sense my unspoken recognition of him. For he looked fixedly and sadly in my direction, and extended his hands, so that I could clearly distinguish the object he held. It was a small cannonball covered with blood. He murmured something, but I could not hear the words. He repeated them several times, but the only one I could catch was country. The vision faded. Mrs. Norton and my hostess had seen all I had seen, and every detail was verified by all three of us. Mrs. Norton said the first words the spirit uttered were in a foreign language, but that he seemed to realize that we could not understand, and he afterwards repeated several times over in English the words, "My poor country." 6 weeks later the Great War started. I understood then the purpose for which I was needed. I was to be used to prove to those whose dear ones had been killed that they were not lost to them and that the dead had never died. During those first few dreadful months of war, many bereaved mothers and widows turned to spiritualism for consolation, and found it. Many who were in danger of losing their reason through grief became sane and led useful lives again, secure in their knowledge that their husbands or sons lived and were waiting for them. I wonder sometimes if many people realized the extraordinary psychic conditions that prevailed during the war, so many thousands of young active men being suddenly shot from their accustomed earth conditions to entirely new ones, which must have been a great shock and surprise to many of them. One could feel the tremendous urge from all these thousands of enthusiastic and loving souls, who probably, I think, certainly longed to come back to FF the loved ones whom they had left behind on Earth. I do indeed feel sure, in my own mind, that all of them really wanted the opportunity of returning, if only for an hour, to comfort those who mourned for them, and to tell them something of their new conditions and surroundings. I remember one occasion on which a direct voice medium visited my home in 1915, and gave a very successful seance to a circle composed of about a dozen of our friends, my husband and myself. The medium's chief guide, a wise and kindly Scotsman, named David, was heard whispering first in one part of the room and then in another. One could hear scraps of conversation such as 41. David, now, then, my laddie, what's your name? Unknown voice, anxiously and urgently, Alec Clark, or some other name, so many were given, I have forgotten them all. David, well, Alec, are ye sure ye know one of the folks here? Because, if not, ye must not interrupt. Ye must stand aside and let the laddies belonging to the folks here come through. Unknown voice, but perhaps one of these people will know my people. Oh, I do want to send a message. David, well, laddie, I'll ask them if they've ever heard your name. Then he would turn round, apparently, to the circle and ask, in a clear and loud voice, do any of you know Alec Clark or his relatives? Perhaps we did, very often we did not. David explained that there were hundreds of laddies present, all longing to give messages in the hope that some of the sitters might one day meet their parents or other relatives. It seemed terribly sad. I wished that I could divide myself into a thousand pieces if only each piece could be used as a channel through which these eager young souls could communicate. All over the country there must have been psychics who were doing their utmost to record the messages given them from those who had passed on, but even so, their number of psychics must have been so pitifully small compared with the extraordinary number of spirits who wanted to communicate. Since then I have been told that there comparatively few who could, and did, succeed in establishing communication with their relatives on our side, told all the others who could not, and it made the gulf between their two worlds seem less to them, though they were deprived of the personal satisfaction of knowing they had given some message containing definite proof of their existence. Fortunately, many bereaved mothers and wives, after experiencing a few successful sittings with a reliable medium, were inspired to try some means of developing their own latent powers, and a good number were able to do this, through table tilting, automatic writing, etc., and then they were able to help other people, too, many of whom might have had, in those days, a prejudice against visiting a professional medium. Of course, in addition to the truly bereaved people for whom I felt it was my special mission to sit, there were certainly a few cranks and eccentric people who were attracted to anything of a psychic nature, simply because it seemed to offer the chance of a thrill, or some excitement. I came into contact with several persons whose egotistical ideas concerning themselves, their own powers, etc., were utterly absurd, yet tragic in one sense, because one felt that they were a discredit to the movement, or might bring ridicule upon it. Page 42. I felt rather desperate after one or two of these people had called upon me, and informed me that they were controlled by Queen Elizabeth, or Socrates, or Shakespeare, all of whom talked the most blatant nonsense, and I wished I could avoid these encounters, as it seemed such a waste of time, and had so undesirable an element in it. During the winter of 1914, Mr. Hewitt Mackenzie, the founder of the British College of Psychic Research, called upon me, anonymously. I had never seen or heard of him before, but Fader gave him what he considered was a satisfactory sitting, and from that time onwards he was of the greatest help to me, sending me just the right kind of sitter. Bereaved, but well-balanced, even skeptical, people, to whom the sittings were of benefit and service. Chapter 13, I Meet a Great Man. One day Mr. Mackenzie personally brought to me a lady in deep mourning, who was obviously in great grief. Her sittings with me brought her some comfort. She knew Sir Oliver Lodge, though I did not know him at this time, and when his son Raymond was killed in the war, in the autumn of 1915, this lady arranged a sitting for an unknown gentleman. It may sound absurd, almost unbelievable, but as it happened I had never before seen Sir Oliver Lodge in person, nor had I ever seen a portrait of him. I had read, or seen, very little scientific or psychical literature, and I had never read anything that he had written. Anyhow, I had not the faintest idea of his identity, but Raymond in this, his first sitting with me, communicated with his father through Fader, and from that time onwards it has been my great privilege to have had many sittings with him, and also with many of the bereaved people who wrote to Sir Oliver, asking him to send them to someone who could give them a message from those who had passed over. Sir Oliver and his secretary, Miss Neo Walker, the authoress and compiler of that wonderful work, The Bridge, took infinite pains in sorting out the genuinely bereaved people, and arranging all details regarding their appointments with me, so that all anonymity could be strictly preserved. Miss Walker used simply to write to me and say, on Monday, December 12th, expect a lady at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, 14th, expect a gentleman same time, and so on. This was a most satisfactory arrangement, both for the sitter and for me. Looking back, I realize now, more than ever, how much I owe to Sir Oliver and his wisdom, patience and kindness. I could never find words that would adequately express my appreciation of all he meant to, and did for, my work. Indeed, where would my work have been without Sir Oliver Lodge's help?